Welcome to the Personalized Medicine Podcast. This is the place where scientists, clinicians, and entrepreneurs discuss the progress of this rapidly developing field. I am your host, Alexander Yahensky. Let's start.
What a year it has been. Wherever you are, we hope you and your close ones are well and safe, and you are getting ready to a peaceful and relaxing holiday season. We have a very special episode for you today, wrapping up season 2 of our Personalized Medicine podcast. I had a chance to sit down with Patrick Short, the CEO of Sano Genetics and host of the Genetics podcast. We've decided to look back at 2021 and reflect on our key highlights of the year in personalized medicine. I had lots of fun discussing this with Patrick and hope that you will enjoy our conversation too. And hey, if you have noticed that we've missed something important in our 2021 wrap-up, let us know on Twitter or LinkedIn. So, without further ado, let's get started with this holiday special end-of-the-year episode.
Great. Welcome, everyone, to this crossover episode between the Personalized Medicine podcast and the Genetics podcast. Sasha and I have been talking for months, actually, on LinkedIn about doing some kind of crossover episode together. So we decided now is actually a really great time to do it. What we're going to do is we're going to recap 2021. Each of us have brought three development stories, call them what you like, that we think are significant through the year and represent some kind of important inflection or event or set of trends that's going to continue for the coming year. So we're going to just do a short introduction to those of you who've never listened to either the Genetics podcast or Personalized Medicine podcast, and then we're going to get right into it. So Sasha, over to you. You could introduce yourself.
Yeah. Hi, Patrick. Hello to everyone in the audience. I'm really happy that we are finally doing this crossover episode. I couldn't be more excited for that. A few words about myself and our podcast. So I am a molecular biologist by training. I grew up in Ukraine, then moved to Poland, studied biotechnology there. I'm currently in Germany where I did my PhD, studying Alzheimer's disease and doing proteomics of the brain, trying to understand the early biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease. And currently work in consulting industry, not a very typical path for scientists, but do this podcast with my very dedicated team of scientists on the back of my daily job. And on this podcast, we speak about personalized medicine. We have lots of guests, clinicians, scientists, entrepreneurs who are pushing the field, pushing the envelope of possible forward, and we like to have conversations with them so they can share their amazing stories with us.
Great. And just a quick intro from my side. I'm Patrick. I'm the host, actually, and maybe I need a co-host of the Genetics podcast. And we've been going for a little over 2 years now. We cover a lot of topics in genetics and personalized medicine, centers around excellent guests, just like the Personalized Medicine podcast. I think we've had a couple in common, actually. My background's in genomics and in particular, large-scale genetic analysis in rare diseases and genetic subsets of common disease. The podcast is run out of Sano Genetics, which is the company that I co-founded, and I'm the co-founder and CEO there. So we're a software platform that helps to accelerate personalized medicine research studies. So excited to do this crossover episode. We're going to get right into it. I'm going to ask Sasha actually to just give a quick intro to his, it's not necessarily his number one. We haven't ranked these in any order, but number one on his list of big developments in 2021. And I'm going to ask a few questions and we'll kick the discussion off. Over to you, Sasha.
Yeah, thanks. I think that was an interesting exercise, right? To just reflect back on the year and try to see what were the main developments, the main highlights of the year that is passing for personalized medicine, for genetics, for the broader field of precision medicine. And I think the one development that I think we both want to pick for this year would be the launch of the massive program, the massive screening program for cancer by Grail and NHS in UK, so-called Galleri or Galleri test, and which aims to detect cancer essentially pre-symptomatically. So I think what is very unique and what is very special about this program that for the first time, that will be a really large trial. I think about 140,000 patients will be recruited into it over the course of next few years to determine essentially whether with a liquid biopsy test we can detect cancer before the symptoms actually kick in. And this is, if that works out, I think we will probably look back at this as a watershed moment in the history, right? We don't know if it will work out. We don't know what the efficiency of this test would be. But shall it work out, that would be a major game changer. Because if we can detect cancer early, obviously the spectrum of treatments that is just available for those patients would be completely different, right? And the possibility of positive outcomes will be much, much higher. So I think that is, for me, for sure, one of the top developments in this year. And I'm very, very curious to see how it will go and how it will develop over the course of next few years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I wonder if maybe you could break down what the bear case is, or those who suspect this won't work. If it doesn't work, why wouldn't it work? And what could be the stumbling block for this from your perspective?
Yeah, good question. I think, well, to be on the skeptical side, right? This might not work for several reasons. I think my biggest fear, at least, that it might be not specific or not sensitive enough, right? So what Grail has proven before, that they are actually able to detect cancer based on the cell-free DNA floating in the blood from those cancerous cells, but they could do it in the patients that have already manifested symptoms, right? So cancer in that group of patients was already diagnosed via other methods. Now, the big challenge, the big question is do we have a sufficient quantity of that cell-free DNA in those patients that can be detected before manifestation of any symptoms? And that's, I think, the biggest question mark, right? If it's still the case, if we can detect that cell-free DNA, if it is there, then it's great. And I think if that barrier is overcome, everything else should fall into place. And then another point maybe that I see that is more on the socio-ethical spectrum of things is, would patients like to know about possibly having cancer or not in advance, right? If the test is sensitive, but maybe it's not specific enough, let's say it returns false positive result, I don't know, in 20-30% of the cases, then we start asking those ethical questions. So shall we stress out patients that maybe are not having cancer in the first place with those false positive results? So I'm curious to see how this will develop.
Yeah. Do you have any sense in the trial how deep they're going to measure those sorts of things? Because this is one of the things that struck me as a big challenge of it, is that they're probably measuring things like healthcare utilization from an economic perspective to say when those false positives come, and they will. What is the cost of all that additional screening? Because this has been discussed for a long time in germline breast cancer and you know, other kind of inherited cancer screening. But it strikes me as a really tricky thing to measure comprehensively. Do you have any sense of how they're measuring that, or what the endpoints besides, you know, false positive, false negative, but to measure actually the economic impact as a whole are?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know that in detail and how Grail wants to test this. So I would hope that at least since they are doing this in collaboration with NHS, they should be addressing those issues. And given just the scale of the trial and the number of patients that they plan to recruit, that would be really important. I think what they are doing right, at least from the outside perspective, is that they are really focusing that on the patients that previously haven't been diagnosed with cancer. I think the enrollment criteria is the patients that haven't been diagnosed with cancer for at least 3 years prior to inclusion to the trial, and that also don't show any symptoms that might be related to any type of cancer. But I agree with you, that would be really interesting to see how they can actually define that this test will have economic and health benefit to the patient and to the healthcare system.
Yeah, I'll definitely be following it closer. One of the things that struck me at the time this was announced about the coverage was also there were a lot of people on taking the negative angle on this about is this where the NHS should be spending its scarce resources? And I'm obviously, like you, quite a techno-optimist and like this kind of stuff. And one of the other stories developments we're going to talk to is probably in the same kind of category as this. But I did think that was an interesting take, where there were some people saying, you know, should we not allocate these resources to many of the more myriad immediate term problems? But obviously there's a case to be made on the other side, which is that this is an enormous and growing challenge that requires a moonshot type solution or set of thinking, at least. So I'm on balance pro running these kind of experiments in the NHS, but it's just interesting and good to see that they are stepping forward and taking these big swings that not everybody necessarily is.
Yeah, definitely. And Patrick, you know this better, and maybe I have actually a question to you in this regard. Why do you think UK is on the forefront of these things? And it's not just about this program. I think when we look at COVID and, let's say, the genetic screening, the genomic screening that has been done in UK, it's pretty much unparalleled to what has been done in any other developed country. So what is special about UK? So why you are so successful in pushing those innovative programs forward?
Yeah, it is a really good question. I think there's and I'm in no way an expert on this, but from what I can see living here, it's seen very much as actually a big economic engine of the country. And so the UK puts out industrial strategy, top-down focus on personalized medicine, genetics. So it's actually not just seen through the lens of how can we use this to better health, but it's seen very much as part of the UK's USP, unique selling point or value proposition on a global scale of we should be at the forefront of this. So I think that's a big driver behind it. And it's the reason why they do a lot of these things. I think there's also some serendipity in that David Cameron had a child that was affected, I believe, by brain cancer, and personally was very motivated to put a lot of money into genomics when it was quite early in its development, and funded programs like the 100,000 Genomes Program. And I think some of these early bets, you know, as you'll know, have compounding effects, where if the decision is made right or wrongly at that time, then you go down that path because you made that decision. So I think a couple of really good decisions 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago. We had the CEO and one of the founders of the UK Biobank on the podcast, and they started almost 20 years ago. I think actually more than 20 years ago now, and only about 10 years ago did they get large scale funding to do genomic sequencing and first genotyping and then sequencing. So a lot of it has been many years in the making, but then big top down decisions from the government and other sources to fund these large projects.
Perfect. Patrick, so I'm curious, what's on your list? What would you pick as one of the biggest developments of 2021?
Yeah, this is another NHS one. It's not going to be hopefully too UK-centric, but this is a good follow-up on this. This has been recently announced that the NHS and Genomics England are working together on a very large-scale newborn whole genome sequencing screening program. And I hesitated on this a little bit because there are many countries that have been doing in large-scale testing for newborns has been expanding. But this is the first time that we've seen whole genome sequencing announced on such a scale. There have been programs. So there's a big program, BabySeq, out of Harvard in the US that has done a lot of amazing work on what parents expect to receive back, the ethical implications and the psychological implications, also the health implications. But again, I think it's just so powerful when an institution like the NHS gets involved in these kind of things, because if it's successful, there's a way for it to actually be translated across to an entire population. So I thought that's what was so interesting and special about this. They haven't announced too many details about exactly what they'll be screening for, but it's looking to be a significant range of initially, I suspect, rare, inherited, severe, and treatable, probably, disorders that they'll be screening for. But it gives a platform to start to test new things, and hopefully roll them out on a national scale in the UK. And I imagine others will follow suit as the program's been successful. So I thought that was a really interesting and pretty big development that I certainly wasn't expecting, actually, if you had asked me at the start of the year.
Yeah, definitely. And Do you know if the idea would be just to do the whole genome sequencing, exome sequencing? Is there a sequencing of specific loci that are related to specific genetic inborn disorders? So what is the end game there?
Yeah, so they're doing whole genome sequencing. And they'll basically be applying an in silico panel. So they're going to sequence the whole genome, but they're not, I actually can tell you, they're certainly not going to report on things like APOE4 status that might tell you about Alzheimer's risk. They will report on, I'm sure, things like SMA and many other, they'll report on, I'm not sure exactly what the flow will go. Probably these participants will already have gone through a heel prick test and come through without any considerations or issues there. But they haven't actually announced what they're going to test for, but they're going to essentially, in theory, be able to test for anything that a whole genome can cover. It's really just a question about what they actually will report on it. And I understand they've made the decision to not report on later in life things. Obviously, APOE4 is a kind of particularly challenging one to discuss, but even some that may be a little bit more straightforward, like BRCA, I imagine they will not be reporting on those, given that it's a 30 to 50 year timeline before any of those children or their parents could make any action, prophylactic action on that.
Got it. And I guess in this case, the storage of the data will remain with the authorities who will do the testing, right? So will patients, in theory, over the long term, get access to their full genome sequences?
Yeah, so in theory, absolutely. My understanding is it'll become part of Genomics England's library. They actually use the metaphor, which I think is great. They call it a reading library. So it's a lending library is somewhere where you can take books out with you, but a reading library is somewhere where you have to go and read the books there. So they have a trusted research environment where academic researchers, pharma researchers can go in and analyze the data. And my understanding is that participants will consent to be part of this program. In the UK, you can make a subject access request, I believe it's called, and actually request access to your data. But I think it's a really operationally challenging thing for them to do because it's such a large file. I don't think they love to get tens, hundreds, thousands of these requests. But I do think there will be a day, certainly within the next 5 to 10 years, where participants will have access to this data because it's so unique, where you only need to test once and you can have a lifetime of interpretation. I think it will absolutely go that way.
Perfect. Yeah. And what do you think, how this can improve our understanding of some of the rare diseases that are maybe even more rare than let's say the average rare diseases that we speak about, like SMA, something that happens maybe in 1 in a million cases, something like that. What type of developments would you expect to see happening on that front?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Where one of the things that I think is interesting about this is it's actually very tricky to do kind of truly population representative large scale genetics cohorts. Almost all of them are really heavily ascertained. So in my PhD, I worked on a project focused on rare neurodevelopmental disorders and childhood disease. And we knew the way that project was structured, you only get into that research study if your child has a rare neurodevelopmental disorder. So it's hard then to make any extrapolations about what the population frequency of a particular disease is. You can with some clever statistics, but one of the powers of this, actually, I think if they plan to just camp out in maternity wards and try to enroll everybody who's interested, is my understanding of the recruitment plan. And it'll be probably something like a third of all babies that they need to enroll in a given year to hit the target. So they actually should get a really very representative sample of the population and a true rate of some of these rare diseases, because there's a lot of open questions about penetrance and having a genetic variant that shows up in people with a particular rare disease. Does it always cause that disease, or are some people actually avoid having the disease due to another protective variant? I think they should be able to help answer some of those questions in a much more robust way than's been possible previously.
Perfect. Yeah, it's great to hear.
It is. It's exciting times. All right. I think we should transition here. I'm going to ask you for your number two on your list, which is a really interesting one. I'm looking forward to talking about it. Over to you.
Yeah. So I think the one that I want to pick also for this year is the progress that have been doing in the field of autologous stem cells and stem cell therapies in general. I think stem cells kind of entered our life with the discovery of iPSCs. I believe it was 2007, 2008. There was a lot of buzz, a lot of hope at the moment. Didn't turn to clinic that fast or as fast as we wanted it to happen due to several limitations in how we essentially manufacture those cells, how we differentiate them into the appropriate tissue, and how we maintain the safety of those induced pluripotent stem cells and prevent them from becoming cancer cells in the human body. But I think there are a few diseases where iPSCs, in general, stem cells, are slowly making their way to clinics. And one that I want to pick for this year specifically would be Parkinson's disease. If you look at Parkinson's disease and why Parkinson's disease is particularly important frontier for stem cells, there is no 100% efficient therapy, right? There are several medications that can be taken to some extent alleviate symptoms. And there is deep brain stimulation, which has proven to be quite effective, especially in the early onset of the disease, but nevertheless, it doesn't treat the disease completely. After some point in time, patients will still deteriorate to the worst state and eventually death. And this is really sad. So what can be done, we can try to rejuvenate or replenish that dying source of neurons to essentially save the patient and make sure that the brain restores its normal function and symptoms of Parkinson's disease essentially disappear. The challenge there is, I would say, twofold. The first one we pretty much overcome over the last few years. It's how to deliver those cells. The good thing about Parkinson's disease in comparison to a lot of other neurodegenerative disorders, you know exactly which cells you need to replace, and you know exactly the space in the brain you need to place those cells into. So it is a very complex type of surgery, but it is, in the way, very precise and very defined types of surgery. And over the course of time, we actually learned how to deliver those cells to that very specific point of the brain. Now, the second challenge is obviously how to get the cells and how to differentiate them to neurons. If you work in neurobiology, you know that neuronal cultures are probably one of the most difficult cultures to maintain in the dish, let alone take those cells out and then reimplant them into the body. So the progress that has been made, and there are a few very exciting clinical trials being published this year. One of them would be from the Blue Rock. This is a company that essentially develops allogeneic stem cell therapies. They take pluripotent stem cells from healthy donors, they differentiate them into the dopaminergic neurons, and they reinject them in the human brain. They've published a very exciting study this summer on the safety and the efficacy of that approach in the first patients. But I think where the true holy grail, and coming to the grail again, lays in this space would be the autologous stem cells. And the reason is that with allogeneic transplantation, you still have the probability of quite severe immune response and overall difficulty into adjusting of those implanted cells to adjust to the environment of the host brain. The developments that we've seen this year coming mainly like from Aspen Neuroscience, the company headed by Jean Lauren. I had a pleasure hosting her on our podcast in the beginning of this year. They're really showing very, very promising results in the way they can take the patient's own cells, de-differentiate them to iPSC state, and they develop a very cool, sophisticated, or not maybe that sophisticated, actually it's elegant test, a genetic test to test for possible teratoma formation. So they have a way to screen the cells, to separate the pool of iPSCs that is actually not dangerous for the patient, and then very robust protocols to differentiate those to neurons. And they're planning to launch that into clinics either next year or the year afterwards. And this is something that I'm very, very much looking forward in the future.
Yeah, I think it's excellent. I'm very fascinated about the allogeneic versus autologous debate. It seems like there's a little bit of a debate going on within the field of ultimately both of them will be, I'm sure of it, will be useful and important, but it seems like there's a little bit of a question of which one will ultimately win the day. And I think you gave a good overview there of essentially autologous is taking somebody's own cells, reprogramming them in some way, and then transplanting them back into them. Whereas allogeneic is so-called off the shelf, where you've taken effectively a donor population of cells and find the one that's the closest match. I'd be really interested in your thoughts on if you had to pick one horse to bet on in that race, and maybe in neuroscience, let's say, to just constrain things a little bit. It sounded like you were saying autologous maybe is your favorite, and I'd be happy to take the other side for the sake of debate. I'm curious which one you think has the most staying power.
Since I'm the host of Personalized Medicine Podcast, I have to pick autologous. I don't really have a choice in this race, right? But like all jokes aside, I think both of them will definitely have their place in the market. And I think that will depend a lot on the condition that is being treated and how easy is it to manufacture those cells and make them safe for the patient. We will see different developments for different diseases. And I don't even think it would be easy to generalize it, let's say, for neurobiology or for cancer, for any specific type of condition or indication. In general, I am a fan of autologous stem cells. There is a, I don't want to say misconception, but probably bias towards thinking that autologous stem cells are necessarily much more expensive to produce. They probably are at this moment of time. The advantage, however, of autologous iPSCs is if we have established protocols, how to first like collect the cells, de-differentiate them, and then differentiate them in the target tissue, you need normally the minuscule number of those cells to essentially treat the patient. And you also don't have to maintain those large banks of, let's say, allogeneic cells and make sure that they are of the right quality, that they don't accumulate, say, cancerogenic or other types of mutations over time, which is also a challenge for allogeneic therapy. So I think it will depend on the specific indication, on the specific type of treatment. There is certainly a lot of benefit in allogeneic therapy when we speak about the CAR T cells. I think there has been a lot of progress in that space, but I'm also curious to see how this will develop over a longer period of time.
Yeah, I definitely share your point that the primary concern, it seems like, is how you scale up manufacturing or the process. But I don't think we're there yet with either autologous or allogeneic. Both have their own challenges. But it seems like if the manufacturing or scalability challenge can be solved, then it's clearly superior for obvious reasons that if you can use someone's own cells. But I don't know enough about it to really speak to is too much of an expert, but I understand that it's got a big challenge ahead to actually get that process to be scalable in a cost-effective way.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, there are, again, a lot of startups who are trying to tackle that manufacturing challenge. We also had Nabiha Saklain from Celino on our podcast. I think developing the differentiation protocols to achieve specific type of cells is hard, but then scaling that up is probably even harder. Just because you need to control for so many different parameters in those very complex environments, and it's not an easy task. So there is plenty of room for developments in that space, manufacturing, quality control, and then actually release of that product as the final drug to the patient.
Is as far as you're aware, is Parkinson's the first disease where is it the furthest along in terms of autologous stem cell therapies and getting to the clinic, or are there others that are that are further along or in a similar ballpark?
Yeah, good question. I don't want to be wrong here, so I would honestly answer that I'm not aware of other diseases that are more progressed in terms of autologous cell usage. Well, maybe if you look at the autologous cells or stem cells in the broader sense, you can argue that some of the cell-based cancer therapies are based on autologous precursor cells. So those won't be iPSCs per se, but those will be autologous cell therapies. But in terms of truly de-differentiated somatic cells, then differentiated into into the target tissue, I think Parkinson's would be one of the first ones to have those type of therapies.
Yeah, I'm also not aware of any others. Maybe one of the listeners who knows more about this than us, if there are others, I'm sure they'll email us or otherwise let us know.
Definitely, let us know. We are doing this show for you, and your feedback is very important for us. So if you have any suggestions or comments, or would like to recommend a guest, please write us an email to team@pmedcast.com. You can also reach us on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Facebook. Just type in Personalized Medicine Podcast and you will find us there. To catch our next episode, subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Please rate us there and leave a comment. This helps us make this show better and reach more people interested in personalized medicine. And now, let's get back to the interview. Great. Patrick, I know that your number two on the list is also very, very exciting. Also concerns those emerging therapies. So why don't you tell our audiences what was your second biggest highlight?
Yeah, it's not exactly a first in and of itself, but it's, I think, a significant continuation of what is going to be a trend for a very long time, which is extremely effective one-time therapies. Initially, I think most of these were for very rare diseases like SMA. However, there are many, many more examples, I think, coming down the pipeline. In particular, two that I wanted to highlight was gene editing of PCSK9 that was initially done in primates. So this is there's a set of genetic variants in this gene that will cause familial hypercholesterolemia, so high cholesterol. And it was shown that a one-time base editing could be made in primates and there'd be durable, at least my understanding is at least 10 months potentially or longer of durable cholesterol lowering. And in humans, this was not gene editing, but in humans, there was a transplant of pancreatic islet cells into a type 1 diabetic person that appeared to essentially fundamentally, and I think in this case, they measured for at least 90 days, but to have a transformative effect there. So these are both two very common conditions. And obviously, I think we're going to continue to see this in rare diseases, but it seems like as a category, these one-time, maybe they're not one-time, maybe they need to be done every couple of years, but shifting from chronic management into something that's much closer to one-time, I think is obviously an amazing development from a technological standpoint. But I'm also really personally interested in how the business models around healthcare need to evolve to cope, to handle these kind of things, which many of the rare disease treatments have been infamous for how expensive they are, but yet they do deliver as much value to the patients and families' lives as is on the sticker price. But our system has not yet figured out how to pay for those at scale.
Yeah, I agree. Like if you look at the price tags, for example, for Zolgensma, I think today the most expensive drug that is available there on the market to treat SMA, that looks scary at the first sight. But what do you think can be the path forward there? How can we bring those therapies to the broader market and make them available for everybody who needs them?
Yeah, I've done a little bit of thinking about this. I know there will be smarter people in our audiences who've thought about this a little bit more, but there's two big differences in health economic or business models between the US where I grew up and the UK where I live now. I think the UK is in a better position because of the vertical integration of the system that the NHS can take a very long-term view on my health and say if it's worth spending £1 million for one dose now if it saves us far more than that and saves your life over a longer period of time. So I think they've got not an impossible chance to solve that problem, but I think there are still significant challenges there simply because of the cost of some of these therapies. And I know if you do the back of the envelope calculation, if therapies were available for every rare disease, then it would effective, and they were the price point that the few that are available today are, it would bankrupt the NHS. But I think that ignores the fact that the prices are going to come down and competition is going to enter the market over the long run. So I actually think vertically integrated systems, national healthcare systems, will be able to figure that out, but it's going to take some time. Where it's more challenging is in the US and other places where health insurance dominates. And I had somebody explain this to me, and it made a lot of sense after they explained it to me, but basically, you're not guaranteed to be with your health insurer for any period of time. I mean, they may expect you to be with them for 5 years or so on average, but if you move to a new state or just simply decide to switch, they have a much bigger challenge, which is if they've paid for that $1 million treatment and then 2 years later you leave and you go to someone else, then their models break down. So the health insurance companies actually have to figure out how to develop some sort of credit system at large to account for the people who are swapping between and the way that value works out of the long run. And so that's just a much trickier problem, I think, to solve it in terms of how this works. And I think it's probably delayed, it will delay the adoption in some of these cases just because it's going to be a little bit more challenging to figure out how to pay for it.
Yeah, definitely. And Patrick, looking at those genetic inborn diseases where one-time treatment can be applicable, what are the other indications where you expect these type of therapies to emerge over the next few years?
I have a personal bias towards the long tail of rare neurodevelopmental and other childhood diseases. One of the big challenges here is it's assumed, I mean, and there's some work backs up, but that there's a window of opportunity where you need to be able to treat the child in order to have, you know, in order to actually have an effect. That if brain development has already, been going for many years, and the child becomes an adolescent or a young adult, it may be very difficult to actually reverse some of those changes. But if we combine the previous discussion we were having about early screening and detection with advances in base editing, gene therapy, other approaches, then I can see a really, I'm very optimistic about a future where diseases can be detected far earlier and actually treated in that window of opportunity. There have been a few papers that have showed in diseases, I believe like Rett syndrome and some others, that window of opportunity is actually, it's not really narrow. It's potentially wider than we think. There may be a few year window where you can actually make meaningful differences, but probably every disease will be the same, and that work needs to be done to figure out which ones need to be treated when.
Perfect.
Great. Now, the next one on your list, I'm excited to talk about because this was completely not on my radar. I had no idea what this was, and I did a little bit of reading beforehand, but I'm excited to hear from you and ask you a few questions. So I'm going to turn it over to you for the next one to talk about glycoproteomic markers and explain to us what that is.
Yes, I guess this is like an orphan highlight, right, on our list. I love glycobiology, so I must confess, and big disclaimer, this is something that my wife has been working on quite extensively in her research career as well, and why I like it. So let me first break this down. So glycoproteomics, glycobiology allows us to measure different subset of biomarkers that is not really that common in modern diagnostics. If you think about diagnostics, you think about DNA, so you would either use PCR or sequencing to detect specific DNA or RNA sequences, or you would use some sort of immunoassays or mass spec to examine proteins, right? These are your two classical type of biomarkers. You might also throw metabolites on top of it, have some metabolomics, but that's essentially it. So when we speak about omics, it's always like genomics, proteomics, metabolomics. But there is this beautiful world of glycoproteomics or glycomics that allows you to measure glycosylated versions of the proteins. And the reason why it hasn't penetrated our routine diagnostics so much so far is that because those glycans, those glycoproteins, are notoriously hard to study. So if you take, for example, mass spec, which has progressed tremendously over the last 20 years and helped us to understand essentially proteins and how they work, it's really hard to measure glycosylated proteins. It's really hard to measure sugars. Although those are relatively simple molecules, if you compare that to DNA again and proteins, they don't, like in mass spec terms, they don't fly well in mass spec, right?
So did they just slip through the net somehow and don't show up?
They slip through the net, and because of the that simplicity in their structure, right? So if, for example, you have glucose or mannose, it's the same chemical formula, and they would generate very similar ions, right? It's hard to distinguish those.
Right.
And then on top of that, you don't really know the sequence of that glycan tree on top of the protein in the first place. Because if you have DNA, you already have sequence banks, you know like what the specific sequence of that gene should be. If you have a protein, you know what the specific sequence of that protein should be because you know the gene that encodes for it. But you have no idea how that oligosaccharide tree on the top of the protein would look like. But that oligosaccharide tree can be extremely important and can be extremely different between healthy cells and cancerous cells. And the development that I've picked as a third one for this year would be the first approved, FDA-approved glycoprotein-based test for cancer detection. And this is actually the test for the pelvic cancer that is developed by the company called Intervene. It's a San Francisco-based company co-founded by Professor Bertozzi, whom I'm a big fan of, and admirer of her work. If she listens to this podcast or somebody in our audience knows her, please let me know because I've been trying to get her on the show.
Introduce Sasha.
Yes, yeah. For a long time. She's essentially the godmother of the field. And essentially what this test allows to do is to, again, detect the cancer much, much earlier. That test also allows to distinguish between benign and malignant type of tumor, which is also not that trivial with the conventional biomarkers. And they have a full pipeline of other cancer indications where that type of approach can be used in the future. So I'm very, very excited about that and obviously a little bit biased as well.
Absolutely. So how does the test, how does the technology work in the way that mass spec and other methods miss these pieces? What are they able to do that allow them to catch them? What's different?
Yeah. So essentially it's a lot of try and error and trying to understand how to deconvolute those signals that are coming from the sugars on the sugar part of the glycoproteins. It also involves a quite complex chromatographic step, right? So you would have to sometimes cleave those sugars, run them on like different columns, try to understand the retention times. How does it differ between different combinations of those oligosaccharides? Then you build the libraries. So you kind of create the empirical knowledge of what the signal should look like. Then you compare those to those databases. And the more knowledge you generate, the better your detection system gets. But I think the essence of this test was just to try to understand, okay, what type of oligosaccharide tree would give you what type of signal.
And then effectively, is it the case that knowing these glycoprotein markers help to differentiate? Is it treatment strategy for the pelvic and ovarian cancer? Or is it tells you something about progression? What does it tell you?
Yeah. From my understanding, in terms of pelvic cancer, it's mainly earlier diagnosis, the first thing. And the second one is ability to distinguish between those benign and malignant tumors, which is not that trivial. For some of the other indications that they have in pipeline, I believe it would be possible to determine the severity of the disease because it's not only just a yes or no type of answer. You might have different type of those oligosaccharide trees on top of the protein, and that, let's say, relative expression levels of specific glycoproteins, if you will, can also determine the severity of the disease and determine prognosis.
Great. What I really liked about this one was I'm blanking on who the famous person who said this was, and I'll also probably get the three in the wrong order, but hopefully I get the spirit right, which is new. The way that science progresses is technology, data, and new hypotheses in that order. It's not, often people think, oh, we've got a new idea and then we go out and test it, but actually the thing that comes first is a new technology that helps you uncover something new, and in this case it's to see where we haven't seen before. So technology, data, and then hypotheses, and then the loop starts again. So it's always, I always love to learn about new views into new parts of biology. Obviously sequencing has been, that's been the story of sequencing for the last 20 years, the amount of discoveries that have come out of just a technological change. But it sounds like there's this is happening here as well, something I should spend a little more time understanding.
I completely agree with you on this approach. And I think that ties very nicely to the last point that you, Patrick, wanted to bring up. And I'm sure we could have talked about this topic for the whole episode.
Yes.
So why don't you tell our audience, what did you pick?
Actually, that's a really good, such a good segue, because it is a new technology and a potentially transformative Uber technology, not just to help to our whole world, but the development I wanted to bring, which again isn't necessarily a single event, but is a continuation of a trend, is there's been some really big advancements in AI, machine learning, and drug discovery. And those of you who know me know that I'm not a kind of complete AI ML fanboy. That's all I talk about. But I think it's a useful tool. But there have been, in particular, a couple of big stories that stood out. The first and foremost is the open sourcing of DeepMind's AlphaFold that enables us, us, obviously I haven't downloaded it yet because I don't spend that much time coding anymore, but anyone who reasonably knows their way around a machine learning model can now download this incredible machine learning model for doing protein folding and predicting the way proteins fold. And I think that this will allow 1,000 flowers to bloom over the next couple of years. And it's remarkable that they've actually made the decision to open source it and not keep it internally to do whatever they do. But I think they recognize that the opportunity for having an impact by open sourcing it was so massive. And there are a couple other kind of smaller stories around this. In particular, some of the leading AI and ML-based drug discovery companies like Recursion and Benevolent AI are striking some pretty significant deals with large pharma. And obviously, these deals can always need to be taken with a grain of salt, because they have payments that are long, long in the future should the molecule succeed. But the fact that people are starting to take these approaches much more seriously, I think there is an opportunity for these kind of approaches to understand data that we're collecting in a way that is impossible for even an army of humans that are trolling over it to do. So I'm very optimistic, cautiously optimistic. Of course, there's lots that still needs to be done to get these AI-generated drugs into the clinic. And I think the detractors will argue that many of these AI-generated drugs could have been discovered by people anyways. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot of interesting things happening there.
Definitely. And Patrick, you already alluded to this. It's probably the field that has so much hype in it. So how do we consciously separate wheat from chaff here and understand what actually might have technological or clinical benefit in the future and what just puts smokes in the eyes?
Yeah, I this is, probably pretty straightforward and maybe obvious, but I think there's two things really. Number one is be honest about the benchmarks that we're comparing it against. So are we making discoveries using this new technology that were truly transformative and humans couldn't do? I think this is with AlphaFold, no one can argue against this, right? There's the you'll hear even the most credentialed X-ray crystallographers that have said things that took me a decade or that we've never been able to crack have been solved by this algorithm. So I think number one is, what are we comparing it against, and is it clearly demonstrably better? Where I don't think the evidence, the preponderance of evidence isn't quite there for many of the origination of new molecular entities or drugs. But I think the second piece is just time. Time will tell. Do these models deliver outsized results compared to what others have? And I think there are many companies that are getting, have considerable backing behind them of people that believe they can. And so I think it will work itself out in the next 5 years or so. Either they will produce significant results or they won't. But I think we're certainly seeing encouraging signs that none of them are going away anytime soon.
Great. And speaking about business and like where the money flows in this space, so where do you see the future of that type of AI drug development? Do you expect large companies to like either acquire some of those smaller players and then fully integrate them, or you expect, let's say, the whole new class of pharmaceutical companies to emerge that will be mainly AI driven and will kind of pump the early assets into the large pharma pipelines?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I suspect that a lot of the power will actually be in the hands. When someone invents a paradigm shifting technology or something that's sufficiently new, I think of Moderna as an example, and they've obviously benefited tremendously from the success that they've had in developing the COVID vaccine. But they have a very novel tech platform that they can go in a million different directions. So they have the option, I think, to build a complete standalone pharmaceutical company. I think the same is the case with many of the AI-based, ML-based drug discovery companies. If they're able to build something that allows them to generate new medicines repeatedly and at scale, I don't see any reason why they couldn't go and do it themselves. What, you know, and my understanding, this is many people in this world to know much more about this, but my understanding is the reason that most companies go through the acquisition process to be acquired by a large pharma is because they believe that either they're going to be able to get to scale and distribution much more quickly by doing that, because those companies have the incredible global reach, manufacturing, all of those other things, or because they're a company that's actually just developed a single asset or set of assets and not a platform technology or something that could just repeatedly generate new assets. So I think for companies that have built the metaphor I often hear is your company a golden egg or is it a golden goose? If it's a goose that lays eggs, then those companies will be able to do it themselves, I think, if they choose to. But if it's merely an egg that you've licensed out of a university or something like that, then probably they'll continue to sell those eggs to large pharma who will help to get them to scale and get them into the hands of patients and doctors that can benefit from them.
What do you see as the next kind of big development in terms of AI-based drug discovery? So we've seen, obviously, with AlphaFold, a lot of things happening in the protein structure deconvolution. Now with Recursion and their deal with Roche, do you think it's indication-specific game, or what will be kind of the next wave of new targets coming out of there?
Yeah, I think there are a number of different applications, even just for AlphaFold itself, that could be pretty transformative. So one is actually in the diagnostic space, which is we have so many challenges in whole genome and exome sequencing of variants of unknown significance. So, a patient has cancer that runs in their family. You sequence the BRCA1 gene, and they have a variant in there, but it's not one of the hundreds, now probably thousands, of known variants that in that gene that cause breast cancer. It is, and the question is that genetic variant pathogenic? Is it cancer causing or at least predisposing or not? There have been some amazing work one off looking at genes like BRCA1 that actually are able to systematically perturb or mutate every base of the gene and ask the question of, does this change the function? Does this change the function? Does this change the function? And actually, you build up a library of every single change possible. And you do this in a cell line. And why this is so powerful is because you'll never see all these variants in humans, but you can do it systematically in the lab and basically build a library and ultimately a model. What I think things like AlphaFold will enable us to do is to not just do that one by one, but to do that in a computer model to say, if we change the DNA by one base, run the program and ask what happens to the protein, and then make a prediction and into how that impacts human health. And ultimately, you need enough observations of human health to be able to feed that back into the top of the model. But I'm really interested to see if it can be applied to improve the way we diagnose. And essentially, it's a way to simulate things you've never seen before in the population using a model that can give you a best guess of what it's likely to do when you do see it.
Yeah, fantastic. And let's watch that very closely, and let's hope that all of these things will happen rather sooner than later.
I'm sure somebody out there is working on it right now.
Definitely. Perfect. Yeah, it has been an exciting year for sure for personalized medicine and for our podcast, I believe, as well.
Definitely.
Patrick, this was a fantastic conversation. We should definitely repeat it next year.
Agreed. Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. I think in early 2022, we should do this and try to predict what's going to happen. And then at the end of 2022, we can get together and realize how wrong all of our predictions were and what happened that we didn't guess would happen.
Exactly. There is nothing more fun than looking back at what you said, yes. what we said before, and just poke holes in that. Great. Patrick, thanks so much for doing this crossover. That's been a pleasure. That was fun. I hope everybody in our audiences enjoyed this episode as well. If you liked it, let us know. We'll try to do this more often. As well, if you think that we missed something really, really important that happened in the field in this year, then please let us know on LinkedIn and Twitter. We'll happily share this with our audiences, because obviously we don't have the full oversight of this ever-growing field, right? It's hard to catch up with everything that's going on these days.
It is, and we did have a couple more waiting around in the backdrop that we prepped, but we decided to cut it just to make sure that we didn't bore you all with having too many of these. But if everybody liked it, then let us know. And if not, you can also let us know. Thanks, Sasha. It was really a pleasure. I enjoyed it. And have a happy holiday as well. Hope you get, if you're traveling anywhere, that you get there safely and things don't get canceled, and stay safe as well.
Perfect. Thanks, Patrick. Same to you. And happy holiday season to our audiences. Rest well.
Yes. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being with us today on the Personalized Medicine Podcast. If you like this show and know someone who would enjoy it too, please share this podcast with them. And don't miss the next episode yourself. Subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcasting app. Please rate us there and leave a comment. That helps us to grow and deliver best experience to you. To access the show notes for this episode, visit our website, pmedcast.com. It's pmedcast.com. Our show notes include guest bios, links to their most notable work, and recommendations for additional reads on the topic of the episode. And if you have any feedback or would like to suggest a guest, write us an email to team@pmedcast.com or reach out on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Facebook. Thank you very much, have a great day, and until next time.